Alan Kring Productions in association with Emergent Light Studio presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2019. Lecture 26 delivered on November 1.
Tonight, incremental free cash flow. Just a quick look at the markets before we begin. As you can see, we had a broad-based down day. It wasn't major on any of the indices. Well, the Wilshire was lost. But as you can see, there was a sell-off in equities. And if you move over, you can see that there was also the metals. There was a sell-off there, too. The bonds, the 10-year bond index, indicates that that money was flowing toward the bond markets, safe markets as they are, almost a 2% rise in price, which suppresses the yields on those bonds, indicating that we're getting a little less pressure upward on the bond market. However, the overall trend has been for prices to go down and yields to go up. We'll see how long we have this reverse of that. But for the time being, it's a good day as far as the economy going into recession because of higher interest rates. Moving on from that, very quickly here, I'm going to take you in and I'm going to show you an example of free cash flow analysis, the incremental free cash flow analysis. It's based on a real story. And I've told that story before, and I'll just repeat it here. Now, I'm going to bring up an Excel spreadsheet. If you want to follow along on your own, you can. However, I also have put this in your resources tab in ReggieNet so that you can see it there and go through each of the steps in it. As much as anything else, once you get the hang of this isn't hard at all. And truth be told, this is about as intense as it can get for this course or even the second course in Corporate Finance 341. Now, let me see if I can find it. USB disk. Here it is. Incremental free cash flow. It's ICFC in your resources tab. This was the story of one of the first companies that created a router for the Internet of Things. And the good part about this is that this company was venturing into something where there was little competition, and also it wasn't going to do any cannibalization of other projects the company had, and it didn't have any synergistics on other products the company had either. So it's essentially very much a standalone project. Before I go any further, though, in this, I want to make sure that you see this separation that is done of the numbers from the calculations on the numbers. A lot of times with these Excel sheets, they just show you these vast, big oceans of numbers, and they don't show you a best practices way to construct these things so that they are flexible. When I put all of the base numbers on a separate sheet like this, I can then change those numbers to do what-if analysis and not have to worry about going back into the formulas in the main sheet. The other nice thing about this is that you can lock the sheet down so that end users can't go in there and play with the numbers and mess up the original sheet. As I told you earlier in the semester, there was a company, a fairly decent-sized company, where they had hired a new guy who was supposed to be good at Excel. He pulled up an Excel spreadsheet, which had been built over years, and he just decided that he was going to fix some things in it. And then, worse than that, he saved it. And then, worse than that, no one noticed it until that saved version had gone to the backup and overwritten the backup. So that was a disaster. And having it like this, you can lock sheets up so that you can minimize those kinds of disasters. But to start off with, the company here was going to sell these at wholesale price to retailers like Best Buy, Circuit City, places like that. So it was planning to sell them at a unit price of $200. They were going to have them built top to bottom in China. And when I say that, I'm speaking from personal experience, as I've mentioned before, when I say that they were going to have them built in China, that means that the unit was going to be built, put in a little plastic, in a plastic bag, slipped into a nice, glossy, four-color print box, and then you could basically say, all right, I want this many shipped to Best Buy, this many shipped to, on a continuing basis. So it's essentially a one-stop, what we call fulfillment house that they were working with. And Amazon does fulfillment as well. Amazon is constantly harping on me. Well, you send us your inventory, and when you get an order, we'll just ship it out right away. And unfortunately, I can't do that with my product. It's art, fine art, and you can't do that. I have to create it. I have to sign it and all that. But even Amazon is fully into this. We'll fulfill it from beginning to end. You just tell us what you want made, and then you can just step out of the way. The one thing, though, is, however, that you'll see that there was an upfront capital expenditure here of $6.5 million. Now, you say, well, they were building it somewhere else. What was this for? That was, essentially, they needed to get some of these units themselves to test them for quality. They didn't want something cheapo built in China that was then going to fail when customers got it and ruin the company's reputation. The other thing was, of course, safety. They had to test them to make sure they weren't going to cause fires and stuff like that. This is a $6.5 million expenditure before the project even begins. This project was going to have an operating life of 4 years, but there would be a year in front where they would be getting ready, and then there would be a tailing year where they closed up the project after the operating life of the project. In some ways, that's kind of good because, you see, if you end a project, if you don't let a project just go on and on and on, that means that you're going to get the free cash flows. They're all going to be more meaningful. Even your salvage value is going to be somewhat meaningful. Let me get down to that here. Along the way, this does have simplifying assumptions. This was not exactly what happened. For example, I'm going to say it's a 5-year straight line depreciation. It wasn't. It was MACRS. So there was more depreciation in the first couple of years than in the back years. It doesn't really affect the cash flow analysis hardly at all, really. Also, as I told you before, the change, a lot of times, we assume that these numbers down on the income statement are percentages of the revenue or percentages of the cost of goods of something else. So in this case, the receivables were going to go up. Once this project was underway, they were going to sell a lot of them, but there would be about 15% of their revenues wouldn't come to them right away. They would be on credit. And so you would have, in any given year of the life of the project, you'd have some receivables, in this case 15%. And the same with payables. In every given year, they figured about 15% of what they owed during that year would not be paid during that year. So your receivables were going to go up, which is a drain on cash, and your payables were going to go up, which was a benefit to cash. So the ultimate result would be what we call the net operating working capital. Finally, now down here now, the salvage value. This project had costs associated with shutdown. There was environmental remediation because there was electronic equipment in it that had to be disposed of properly, and there were other things. But the lab equipment was only 4 years old, so that meant that it still had some decent market value in it. And they let it burn down to book value of zero, so the tax was right on the salvage value. But one way or the other, it did come out to be a slightly positive salvage value. And I included this on an after-tax basis. And you have to have a discount rate. Where this discount rate came from, I can't tell you. I have no idea. I would like to say, well, it came from the capital asset pricing model. They did it that way. I don't know. They might have just pulled it out of thin air. I'll have a little bit more to say about that. But anyway, the company was going to have them made at, was going to sell them for $200 a pop at wholesale price. They were going to have them made at $90 a pop. And the unit, okay, this is a term that is technically not right to use, but it's old, old school. I've used it myself. It's called unit margin. It's the revenue minus the cost per unit. Okay, and we call that your unit margin. In this case, the unit margin would be 200 minus 90, or they would make a margin of $110 per unit that they sold. And they built and sold. And we're assuming that they sold everything they built in a given year. So keeping that in mind, and also the cost of goods sold is 45% of revenue, and your selling, general, and administrative expenses were going to be 25%. A little note about that. This was very much a compact project. All of the costs of this project were contained in that lab. The testing, the electric bills, the testing and the personnel, even the division, the product management was in this, in that one place. So that SG&A covered everything that had to do with this project, contained it in a nice way for our purposes of looking at the costs associated with it. Taking all of that aside, I'm going to just bring you over here. And at first, it might look a little intimidating. How the hell did you do that? It's actually very easy. I've got all of the assumptions on a separate sheet. So, for example, for revenue, right here, see this number right here? All I did was take, and I'm going to do this again, watch what I do here. I'm going to say, all right, the revenue would be equal to, and I'm going to go back over here to the assumptions. I'm going to say that that would be the wholesale price, 200. Now, I'm going to make that an absolute reference by hitting F4 because that's going to keep it in place as I sweep that formula and copy it. So I hit F4. See, that makes those dollar signs. That freezes that number so that it won't move when I move the cell reference. And then times, okay, I sold 44,000 units. And I'm going to make that an absolute reference so that it doesn't try to look that way as I copy the formula. Now, you could put numbers there if you thought that you were going to sell different numbers of units in different years. I simplified that in this. By the way, it was a flat sales profile. Okay, and then I say, okay, there we go. That's where I got that. And then I just take that and I copy it over to the other three operating years. That's why it's nice to do that absolute reference, because it freezes in place the numbers that you don't want to Excel to go looking for somewhere else. Now, the cost of goods sold, I did the same thing. All I'm going to do is just take this and I'm going to say, all right, for cost of goods sold, that would equal, I go over here to the assumptions and I say cost of the outsourcing. And then I'm going to hit F4 to freeze that one when I copy it over. Times. And then I'm going to just take the units sold again. And there it is. And then once I've gotten it in one cell, I can just drag it over my ass. Oh. See, I did that on purpose so that you would... Oh, dear. Fine. F4. Are you happy, Mr. Excel? There. Mess with me, will you? I'll show you an absolute reference or two. Okay. Anyway, now the gross margin is just revenue minus cost of goods sold. So that's how I got this. I just said equals that minus that, and then I just simply say, okie dokie, sweep that over. One thing that is important, that's kind of like one of the things about this, notice how I do as little work as I can in Excel. I let this, that dragging that little crosshair over make what was one column into something that looks pretty fancy and awesome. No, you don't have to do all of these columns one by one. If you set up the formulas properly and know how to do absolute addressing, then absolute referencing, then you can get huge sheets done with doing one column and then copying. Now the SG&A is, again, all I'm going to do is I'm going to say, okay, then the SG&A is going to be equal to, I look over here, and it said the SG&A was selling general administrative was going to be 25% as an absolute reference times, and then I say revenue, was it? Yeah. No, of cost of goods sold. Cost of goods sold, yeah, right there. What did I do wrong there? Oh, you're right, I did. Let me try that one more time. Or maybe I should just leave the heck alone. equals selling general and administrative, that would be the 25% right there as an absolute reference times times the cost of goods sold. Yeah. Times revenue, I'm sorry. Times revenue. There it is. And then you just copy that over the same way. And again, notice that I'm doing only one column and then fixing all the other columns. Now, depreciation. I straight line, so all I'm going to do is say it's going to be equal to the original capital expenditure right here. And I'll make that an absolute reference. Divided by, or times 1/5, whichever way you want to do it, times 1 over the number of years here. Notice that the more numbers you get into that assumption worksheet, the less actual numbers you have to put into this. Notice how so far I have not put in one actual number in this entire worksheet. Oops, I did it again, didn't I? Yep. Why do they allow me not to be put in a home? There. Now, I want to bring up something here. This is something I mentioned before, and here's a real example of it. See that $1,300 that's out there after operating life of the project is over? We call that a tail. In this case, that's a depreciation tail. And I mentioned the one, interestingly enough, I so saw this when I was doing those low-income housing for the elderly. Those apartments weren't going to last more than 10 years. But we were required under accounting rules to have a depreciable life of 20 years. So we had a 10-year tail on these projects. It was just ridiculous how long the tail was. In a case like that, you just take salvage minus book or something like that and just eat it yourself. But in this one, it was just a one-year tail, so it was just carried out to this fifth year, and that's where the salvage and a few other things were. Now, EBIT, all that is, you're just going to take your gross margin minus your SG&A, selling, general, and administrative costs, and your depreciation, and you get your EBIT, otherwise known as operating income. This is the end of where finance and accounting dance together. The dance card is now thrown away. The next thing the accountants would do is say minus interest expense equals, and then do earnings before taxes minus taxes, etc., down to the, and that's your earnings before taxes minus taxes is your net income. We don't go there. We don't worry about that. You see, because we don't worry about the interest expense, because the interest expense is embedded here in the cost of the project. We don't do it. And that's the big difference, is at this point, all we do is take the tax bill, the tax, which is at that time, the top marginal tax rate was 39%. And so we just take 39% of EBIT, and that gets us NOPAT, the net operating profit after taxes. NOPAT. And so these are just, in this case, EBIT on this line, all I do is take the EBIT times, by an absolute reference, the marginal tax rate. Notice how nice that is. If the tax tables change, then I can just change the number here in this other worksheet instead of going through the spreadsheet itself. Anyway, we've got our NOPAT. Now we build and take down according to actual what happened. The first thing we're going to have to do is put the stupid depreciation back in, because the only reason we took it out up there was because there's a tax shield from it. But once that's taken care of, we've got to add the depreciation back, because that didn't really happen. A capital expenditure, a whopping capital expenditure happened, but the depreciation never actually happened. So we're going to add back the absolute value of that number. The depreciation was a negative. And so what we do is we add back the absolute value. That's why you see that ABS of the reference to the depreciation, absolute. And then we just copy that across, because it's the same number as up here, so we just copy it. Again, everything I'm doing here is simply for the purpose of making my life a little easier doing this. Okay, receivables. Now, here's where we have to start paying attention to year zero. Because in year zero, there was no revenue, so there were no incremental receivables in year one, in year zero. So I can put a zero there, because zero revenue times, well, actually, I could even do that right now. I could put a zero revenue in here. And I could put a zero revenue in here, too. A zero cost of goods sold. Matter of fact, I could even back copy that. And I could put a zero there, too. Whatever. Okay, but anyway, one way or the other, there were no receivables from the project, because 15%, which was the receivables amount on revenue, 15%, absolute reference times the revenue is going to give us a zero. Similarly from payables. Our accounts payable, the cost of goods sold was zero, so 15% of that is going to be zero. As you can see there, I took the 15% of cost of goods sold line right there, and then I simply multiplied it by the cost of goods sold for the year. And then the net operating working capital is just your current assets minus your current liabilities. So the net operating working capital for year zero is zero. And then I can just copy those across and I've got that. It's that simple. Once you get one column, if you've done it right, you can just keep copying. Now, here's where it gets interesting. Because the change in net operating working capital is last year's minus this year's. That's a change. In this case, notice that net operating working capital went from zero to 726,000. That means that there was a negative cash cash flow because money went into receivables instead of revenue. So my revenues are overstating the cash that the company had by that difference. So, and then all I do is take then, notice, and this is something I mentioned in the last class. Here it is. The change in net operating working capital is the previous year's minus the current year's. And so all I did for this was to, I can just say, okay, now I copy this over. Notice that if the net operating working capital in year one is 726, and it's still 726 in year two, you have no change. Similarly, year two to year three, it stayed at 726, so there was no change. Same money went out that came in. And again, only at the end, where you go from 726 in net operating working capital back down to zero, the project is over, then you have 726 dropping to zero means you have a cash inflow of $726. I mentioned this on the last lecture. See how these two numbers are the same. That is what probably should happen, something like that if it's a simple problem. And essentially, the question, and I'll mention this again, well, if these are this, in year one, it goes down 726, and then in year five, it goes up 726. Why do you even bother? Well, the problem is that this 726 out in year five, as a present value, isn't the same as the 726 that went out at the beginning. So you have to include them both because they have different impact on the net present value. Finally, capital expenditures came in year zero. You spent this money, there it is. There's your dinner right there. And then there's no more capital expenditures for the rest of the project. Salvage value. There's no salvage value until it's over, and then the salvage value is that $40,000 that you referenced from the assumption sheet. And you say, well, okay. Here's the nice thing, though. What happens is that now I've got incremental free cash flow. All I do is I simply take my NOPAT. You're saying, well, there's no NOPAT. Doesn't matter. I just take for the year zero, NOPAT, B10, minus the change in net operating working capital. Wait, let me look at this again. NOPAT plus the depreciation. I'm sorry. NOPAT B10. Plus adding back the depreciation, B11, minus the change in net operating working capital, and then I take out the capital expenditures, which were negative. It's minus, but they were already negative, so I put it as a plus in this one. And then plus the salvage value. You say, well, there's no salvage value. But if I put it here in this year zero incremental free cash flow column, I can just copy that over, and when things happen, they happen. My ass, what happened there? Did I miss something? Yeah, the numbers changed. Well, that's awkward. Did I do that right? Okay, NOPAT plus depreciation, that should not be a negative. I've copied something. I've wrote something wrong in the formula. Control Z, fix it. Okay, I've got B10, NOPAT. Okay, let me do this. Equals B10, NOPAT, plus depreciation, minus the change in net operating working capital. Oh, it should be plus the change in net operating working capital because it was already a negative. Okay, I see what I did. Plus. Okay. I think that should take care of it. Let me make sure. Phew, thank God. And then finally, I can do the net present value. All you see here, is what I do is it equals NPV, and you tell it first your discount rate, 12%. And then you tell it the incremental free cash flows. That was this stream right here. So I did equals NPV, net present value, open the parenthesis, and then I reference the discount rate, comma, and then I say, here is the free cash flow, incremental free cash flow stream, close the parenthesis, and I get a slightly negative NPV project. Slightly. So, what's a mother to do here? This project should have been rejected, but it was so close, they accepted it. And interestingly enough, it turned out to be a very successful project. And the question then in case studies is, okay, where did they actually go wrong? They did the right thing. They accepted it, but they accepted it when they should have rejected it. It turned out it was a good project. So where was they? Did they go wrong? It was most of us say they used a discount rate that was too high. 12% represents a pretty risky project. And they didn't appreciate it at the time, but the Internet of Things was not going to go away. It was going to become dominant, and it is still growing in its influence. Your appliances, your cars, your mobile phones, everything is talking to each other. Just like you're walking along texting, and that's why I run over you with my car. Yeah, your appliances are doing the same thing. They're busy. So realistically, maybe something more like about a 10 would have been the right one. But one way or the other, this is incremental cash flow analysis. This is all there is to it. Literally, I said this a while ago, you take my more advanced corporate finance course, I'm going to show you the same examples, just like this one. I did want to show you, like I said, I'm going to put this up. I'll have to make a fix, or maybe I should let you make the fix on that, one way or the other. I'll have to check my other numbers. There might be something else that was going on, too. But one way or the other, matter of fact, let me save this real quick here. Save. Before I forget to, and it's available now, but it has this little mistake or something going on in it, and I'll fix that, and I'll re-upload it later tonight or tomorrow. I'm sure you'll be spending a lot of time looking at this during the Thanksgiving holidays, or not. I want to show you something here, fairly brief. It's something important, though. A problem we have, especially when you go to college, is that sometimes you begin to know things that are not opinion. They're just facts, mathematical facts, or scientific, or business, or engineering. And it sounds like you're giving an opinion when you're not. But you can't explain because the people you're probably going to tell this who would disagree with you are going to think that they are as intelligent as you are. And unfortunately, no, they're not. But I'm going to show you something interesting here. It has to do with something in this incremental free cash flow analysis. I had to scribble this down, get these so I wouldn't forget the numbers. Remember I told you about the gluten-free, high-fiber pastry? Okay. Excuse me. Here are the numbers, somewhat simplified again. I don't need to give you dollars and cents and all that, but somewhat simplified. Now, the company here was, this was going to be the company's pre-tax without the pastries project. It was going to be $460 million. In other words, that would have been the EBT. This project was hella expensive. It was $15 million right up front, and that was expense. That was not capitalized. They were going to spend a lot of money on this stupid thing right up front, and it was they were going to take the hit on it on their pre-tax. So that amount that they were going to... up front cost of pastries project was going to be $15 million. You understand that they were trying to make something gluten-free that tasted good. That is hard to do. I've tried to make gluten-free food. In other words, they were committing a serious amount of money, 15, if they did the project. So here's the interesting thing about it. What that would mean is that without, let's say that their tax break, just to make it a little easier, was 40%. Like that. Okay, so in other words, if they hadn't done this project, they would have paid 40% on $460 million pre-tax, which would come out to be $184 million. That's a lot of tax money. Over here, if they do the project, then their pre-tax would be $460 million minus the $15 million, which would have brought them down to a $445 million pre-tax. At 40%, that would be $178 million in tax. There's the key. The project was going to save them $6 million that they would have sent to Uncle Sugar. Do you see it? The project saved them by taking on this project. They would realize $6 million in taxes not paid. They wouldn't have to pay them. In other words, the upfront cost of this project isn't $15 million, it's $9 million. That's an important thing right there. These projects are actually tax shields. But the more important point is this. Do you see that that tax shield is bigger the higher the tax rate? If you drop this tax rate from 40% to 20%, which is what it is about now, 21%, the tax shield becomes half as good. In other words, by having a high tax rate, you induce companies to make capital expenditures so they don't have to pay that tax. If you just lower their tax rate, they get the bonus of extra money saved in taxes, but they don't have any requirement for what they do with it. Again, if you look at this, by having a high tax rate, it almost forces the company to make big capital expenditures to avoid the tax. But if you lower their tax rate, yeah, they'll save the money. They'll still save money on their taxes, but there is no reason why they would use that money to do projects. It's not tied. Saving the tax dollars is not tied to capital improvements, to new products, to new inventions, to new technologies, to new services. If you drop their tax rate, yeah, they're going to save a lot of money on taxes, but they save it whatever they do. But if you have a higher tax rate, then they will save the tax money only by capital expenditures. That's an interesting consequence. It's the same thing. Look, you, sir, are a welfare queen. Okay? I can either give him $200 a month, or I can give him $200 a month if he works a job at minimum wage. Which one is going to induce him to be a productive citizen? You understand that if we attach, you get tax savings, but only if you do things, then they will do things. If I say you will get the tax savings regardless of whether you do anything or not, you're probably not going to do it. Why would you work if you didn't have to, if you got the money? That's exactly what's happening here. It's too complicated to explain to an average person who hasn't had a business course like this. But it's clear that, they're saving tax money by taking on the pastries project. You lower their tax rate, they'll save money on their taxes even if they don't do the pastries project. Interesting little thing to think about when you're hearing about low taxes and high taxes on corporations. Now, I'm going to give you your quiz. And once you're finished with that quiz, that will be all I have for you tonight, and I will thank you.